Welcome to the Skirbel Center for Adult Jewish Learning at Temple Emmanuel. You're listening to a podcast of the annual Charles Grossman Lecture given by Professor Deborah Lipstadt on March 6, 2012, on the topic of History Written, History Rewritten, on America, the Holocaust, and Playing the Blame Game.
At a talk I gave in Westchester a number of years ago on America's response to the Holocaust, the audience was thoughtful, well-read, and passionate about the topic. Few of those present were of an age to really remember the war years. Most were aging baby boomers and younger. The premise of my talk was that the United States certainly could have done more, far more, to help, if not save, many Jews during the 1930s and 1940s. I acknowledge that official Washington was decidedly reluctant to speak out about the situation of the Jews, and until Kristallnacht in the fall of 1938, to adjust immigration regulations. Jews who sought entry into the United States found a variety of obstacles in their path. Some were generic, i.e., any immigrant faced them, but others were decidedly specific to Jews, and were placed there by government officials, American government officials, desirous of blocking Jews' entry into the United States. However, I cautioned my audience, one must contextualize the response of the Roosevelt administration within the then prevalent American anti-immigrant, isolationist, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic sentiment of the 1930s. Americans in general had no desire to either become entangled in German affairs or to see an influx of Jewish refugees land on these shores. Once America entered the war after Pearl Harbor, its options for acting to help Jews were even more constrained, particularly during the early years of the war, when there was legitimate doubt as to whether the Allies were going to emerge victorious. In short, I argued that while there was certainly far more that the United States could have done to admit Jews before the war and rescue them during the war, the extreme criticism directed specifically at the Roosevelt administration is somewhat unwarranted. It was doing precisely what most Americans wanted it to do, first keeping America out of war and refugees, particularly Jews, out of America. After this analysis of the Roosevelt administration, I turned to the American Jewish community and its leadership, noting that they too are today subjected to severe criticism. I acknowledge that in the 1930s and even into the 40s, American Jews conducted their communal affairs in a quote-unquote business as usual mode. Petty jealousies persisted even while the situation in Europe grew more dire. Often the American Jewish community invested much more energy in fighting one another than in fighting for policy changes. However, I posited that many contemporary critics today of the American Jewish community of the 30s and 40s, failed to consider sufficiently the barriers that Jews faced at the time. American Jews feared stirring up anti-Semitism. They worried that if they protested too much, they might give the broader American public reason to think that they were more loyal to their European co-religionists than to the United States. They wished to avoid being accused of having pushed America into a war. While in retrospect, today knowing what was coming, in retrospect their fears may seem paltry, especially when balanced against the threat facing European Jews, I again urged my listeners to nonetheless contextualize the political situation at the time and not to fall prey to what we historians call presentism, imposing contemporary standards for political action on an entirely different era. I observed that the modus operandi of the post Holocaust American Jewish community, the one that managed to make the freedom of Soviet Jews an American foreign policy agenda, or to galvanize a majority of the Congress to adopt a strong pro-Israel position, was not an option in the 1930s, and even less so during the war years of the 1940s. Needless to say, during a heated question and answer period after my lecture, many audience members challenged my position. Within a few weeks after my speech, I received a 5-page scathing letter, and I know from scathing letters, and this was scathing. I got a whole file of nice letters worth keeping, ugly letters, I don't know why I'm filing them, but I filed them anyway. A scathing letter with a copy to the congregational rabbi, no less, accusing me of whitewashing America's wrongs, making light of the death of European Jewry, and being an apologist for American Jewry of the 1940s. While the letter was even more extreme than the criticism I had encountered in the synagogue, it wasn't unique. It echoed a view that I have repeatedly encountered from contemporary American Jews when I suggest that they contextualize Roosevelt's and the American Jewish community's behavior. Shortly after the incident, with the angry letter in my consciousness, I began my research for this paper. I immersed myself in an array of books, articles, films, all chosen to measure up how post-Holocaust critics assessed the response of the Roosevelt administration and the American Jewish community to the final solution. So I wasn't studying precisely what happened, but I was studying the historiography of how people wrote about what happened. During much of my research, I felt as if I was on the teacup ride, a Disney World or Disneyland feature in which riders sit in a teacup that spins in one direction, even as the platform on which it is spins in the other direction. Do not do this after a meal. The preponderance of these works tell by now a familiar version of history. The United States, with Roosevelt at its helm, failed to act vigorously, if at all, to save Jews. The American government was riddled with either latent or sometimes blatant anti-Semites or self-effacing Jews who did not wish to help European Jews. American officials erected paper bureaucratic walls to keep Jews out in the 1930s and abandoned them to their deaths in the 1940s. These versions of history posit that had American Jews pushed President Roosevelt to act, many, if not most, European Jews could have been saved. And these versions of history also argue that American Jews, fearful of provoking anti-Semitism, had little empathy for their fellow Jews and believed FDR to be their best friend, the best friend they had ever to occupy the White House. These critics also focus on, of course, the established American Jewish community, which, led by Rabbi Stephen S. Wise at the time, rarely directly and openly challenged American policy. Wise, the critics argue, failed to utilize his close working relationship with Roosevelt in order to ask help for his fellow Jews. They make the point that Rabbi Wise even kept silent in August 1942 when he received a telegram sent by the World Jewish Congress's representative in Switzerland, Gerhard Regner, to a member of the British Parliament. Regner sent this copy to a member of the British Parliament, and the member of the British Parliament sent the telegram forward a copy on to Wise. The telegram suggested that there was a strong possibility, Regner in this telegram of August 42 said there's a strong possibility that the Germans intend to exterminate all European Jews. Wise gets the copy of the telegram through from Britain, and he turns to the State Department to ascertain whether they had any more information. He asked the I got this telegram, what can you tell me about it? What Wise didn't know is that when Regner sent this telegram to this member of parliament, this Jewish member of parliament, he also sent a copy to Wise. What happened was, through the diplomatic pouch, the State Department embargoed the copy to Wise, so Wise never got that copy. But when the guy in Britain got a copy, he sent a copy of his to Wise. And the State Department couldn't embargo it because it was coming from a member of Parliament. Regner was a private individual using the diplomatic pouch, but when a State Department member was sending a copy of a telegram, they couldn't get it. So Wise was getting a copy not knowing that Regner had sent him one as well, which the State Department had embargoed. The State Department didn't want Wise to have this information precisely because he might use it to call for action. But they couldn't stop, as I said, they couldn't stop the British copy from getting to him. The State Department asked Wise to keep silent while it ascertained whether there was any truth. So that's August 42. This is the height of the killing, by the way. The killings start in the summer of 41, and by the end of 42, beginning of 43, most of the Jews, with the exception of Hungarian Jews, who will be killed, are already dead. Wise is charged by the critics, by these contemporary critics, with having, quote, sat on the report, having actively collaborated with the administration to keep the news from American Jews. They are scathing him. How could he get this information in the summer of, in August of 42, and sit on it for 3 to 4 months? He failed, his critics assert, to use his close personal relationship with President Roosevelt to get him to act. The more extreme critics absolve Roosevelt almost and focus almost all their blame, shift all their blame onto Wise. Rabbi Isaac Lewin, the leader of Agudat Yisrael, a fervently Orthodox group, said that Wise's approach typified their business-as-usual behavior. Rabbi Lewin wondered, was the storm of protest from Jewish leadership over atrocities which had no parallel in our history. The same groups which so severely castigate Roosevelt and Rabbi Wise and the established Jewish community, of course, are generally much more favorably inclined towards a group of young Palestinian Jews, as they were then called, who had come to America to work for the creation of a Jewish army. This was a project of Zev Jabotinsky, the revisionist Zionist, and his younger associate then, Menachem Begin. They felt that there had to be a Jewish army fighting this war effort, which was destroying Jews as Jews. And one of the people who agreed with them, ironically, just to go back to my Eichmann work, was Hannah Arendt, who also believed there had to be, you can only fight as the person you are attacked. But when this group of Palestinian Jews learned that of what was going on in Europe, they set aside the goal of a Jewish army in order to devote themselves fully to pushing the American government to rescue European Jews. They were led by a young man who was named Hillel Cook, who was a nephew of the chief rabbi, but to avoid embarrassing the chief rabbi, he took the nom de plume of Peter Bergson. They relied on rallies, political lobbying, eye-catching advertisements designed to challenge, if not attack, FDR and his policies. They accused the United States of willfully turning its back on persecuted Jews, and they demanded of the Jewish community that every issue, including the establishment of a Jewish state, which was a major concern of Rabbi Wise's, be set aside to focus on rescue. Now, how have this group been treated? In the 1982, PBS did a documentary, broadcasted documentary by Lawrence Jarvik called Who Shall Live and Who Shall Die, which extolled Bergson's work. And the film charged that American Jews were not only unprepared for such an emergency, but did nothing to shake up Roosevelt or wake up the world. They weren't interested, the film argued, in bringing these Jews to America. If they had been willing, many of the Jews killed alive in 42 could have been saved. That documentary was followed 2 years later by David Wyman's Abandonment of the Jews, which galvanized coverage of the topic. Wyman was fiercely critical of America and of American Jewry. Another PBS documentary a few years later was part of the popular series The American Experience, and narrated by no less than David McCullough, it drew heavily on Wyman's work. And the film's premise was clear from the outset. In the first 30 seconds of the film, McCullough says that during World War II, 6 million Jews were killed as America stood by, implying that America could have saved those 6 million Jews. And the film implied that America had purposely abandoned these Jews. The strangest manifestation of anger towards the wartime Jewish community came in 1984, and some of you may remember this, when a commission headed by the then former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg was established to explore American Jewry's response to the Holocaust. Funded by a wealthy Holocaust survivor, the commission was supposed to conduct a balanced investigation. Its bias, however, was clear from the beginning when the question sent out to the people on the commission, one of the questions was, why were so many American Jews passive or relatively unconcerned about the plight of European Jews? The question wasn't, were American Jews passive, but the premise was already that they were passive. And then it polled the members of the commission for their answers. This is not generally how historians do their work. The composition of the commission also belied the fact that this was not a historical enterprise. Among its members were Brooklyn DA Elizabeth Holtzman, New York City Comptroller Harrison Golden, and other heads of organizations whose actions were going to be investigated. Essentially, what this commission was doing was putting American Jewry on trial, American Jewry of the 1940s on trial. Another member of the commission was Dr. Bruno Bettelheim, whose record as a child psychologist was then still intact, but whose qualifications as a historian were, on this period, were and remain non-existent. So it got a lot of attention, but it really was a disaster as far as history was concerned. And the first draft of the report, which was written actually by a Birx and associate, accused American Jews of being being egotistical during the time, accused members of the commission, and then it turned on members of the commission. The whole thing was a disaster. It ended with members of the commission fighting one another. But by the early 1990s, this assumption that America and American Jews had purposely done nothing. Now, again, I want to remind you, and I feel a bit defensive, but I know some of you may be, I want to remind you that I absolutely agree that America could have done more, and more people could have been saved, particularly during the 1930s. There's no question about it. But what the difference is, was it a purposeful turning on European Jews? Was it a we'd rather have them die there? Was it American Jews being callous, et cetera, et cetera? In fact, some of you may have been there as well. I was present when the United States Holocaust Museum was dedicated, and I clearly remember President Bill Clinton speaking of America's failure to respond. And this is a bipartisan view. In 2008, when President George W. Bush was visiting Yad Vashem, he stopped in front of a photograph of the railway tracks leading to Auschwitz, and he turned to then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and said, "The United States should have bombed it." But this wasn't the only material I found. So there's this extreme criticism on one end. Why the teacup? There's this criticism. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a whole other body of criticism. And it's smaller, but it's equally passionate. And written in response to the critics, it's really a defensive position. It argues that FDR deserves praise for his actions, that he not only saved Jews, but rescued every Jew who could have been saved. He led the Allies to victory, and by leading the Allies to victory, he ensured that millions of Jews did not fall into German hands. Now, much of the work of this defensive school comes from allies and people who worked either with FDR or who followed him very closely, Arthur J. Schlesinger Jr., William Vandenhoevel, and they argue that, and others around them and people in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Institute, they argue that a terrible historiographic wrong has been done to one of the most, quote, liberal, generous presidents who conducted one of the most successful attempts to rescue oppressed refugees in modern history. They, according to the school of thought, not only did FDR do all that was possible, but any additional American rescue efforts were during the Holocaust were impossible. Schlesinger argues that there's a striking disregard of historical context, and he agrees with Roosevelt's position that the best way to save the Jews was to bring the war to as quick an end as possible. They attack Wyman for his unsubstantiated calumny against men as least as honorable, humane, and honest as Professor Wyman. They are joined by Lucy Davidovich, joined them in their attacks, William Rubinstein, and a lawyer who got a lot of attention when he came out with a book, Robert Rosen. But this was this severe defense of FDR. So it's not uncommon when you read books that posit two wildly different positions, that when you read one book, you say, oh, they're right. And then you read the other book and you say, oh, they're right. This is why Paul had a teacup ride. I would read this extreme position and I say, this can't be right. This is too far. And then I would read this other stuff and I say, this can't be right. This is too far. And I felt like I was spinning in multiple directions at the same time. Now, I don't come to this topic, and I know some of you here have known my previous work, Tabula Rasa. My first book on the Holocaust was a book on the American press coverage, American press and the coming of the Holocaust. And I subsequently helped research and wrote portions of the exhibit at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum on America's response to the Holocaust. And I was exceptionally critical, and am exceptionally critical. And I haven't changed my opinion. I say, America could have done much more. But what I've become disturbed by is the vituperative nature of these two bodies of criticisms. It seems to me something else is going on here. And I don't want this presentation to be part of this ongoing debate about what America could and could have done, but I know it's almost impossible to study something without that happening. But I want to ask, what are the prisms through which these two extreme bodies of critics on one side and on the other side, through which their views are refracted? Is there something else, something other than just a historical debate which motivates those at both ends of the spectrum? I'm particularly interested in the assessment of the Jewish community's behavior by current generations of American Jews. Might some of those conclusions be shaped by contemporary realities as much as by history? Is it possible that sometimes when this argument is going on, that it's a foil for discussion of today as much as it's a discussion of history? Are we being exposed to historical research that is measured, at least to some degree, in a settling of old scores? Is the debate fueled not just by history, but by varying perspectives, even today, of what it means to be an American Jew? What can we say about the arguments posed by these two schools of thought? Both speak some truth while overstating the case. The critical school correctly says that visa policies were designed to keep Jews out of the United States. Consular officials throughout Europe made refugees run a gamut of obstacles to prevent them from entering this country. Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long acknowledged as much in 1940. Despite the fact that there was no proof in 1940, the State Department promulgated the notion that refugees coming to this country were part of a fifth column. They would be spies. And FDR, by the way, was struck by how fast France had fallen to the Germans. FDR was completely perplexed by this, and he was sure that it was a matter of fifth column, not that the Germans were just a much better and stronger army than the French, but he was sure there must be spies. And so when the State Department said, we've got to keep refugees out because they could be a fifth column, it seemed to make sense to him. You can criticize FDR. There's much to criticize him for. When he gave press conferences, he gave many of them, he rarely spoke of the situation of the Jews. And if he did, he made sort of general comments about unfortunate people. Throughout 1933, when the persecution of the Jews seemed, of course, it pales in comparison to what will follow, but it's this new regime and they're kicking Jews out of jobs and preventing Jews from doing things and firing public lawyers lawyers and firing judges and firing school teachers, etc., the subject of the persecution of the Jews throughout that year arose just once and not at Roosevelt's initiative, but because someone asked a question. The most disastrous thing about FDR's silence was that the Third Reich interpreted as the fact that America didn't care. And that was a disaster. What about the American Jewish community? Did it really not care about the fate of its fate of its fellow Jews? Was it steadfast loyalty to FDR? Did it really compromise any political clout it might have had? Was the established leadership more focused on fighting Bergson than on changing government policy? There was a great deal of internecine warfare, of civil war among American Jews at the time. Now, sometimes it involved issues of power and pride. Who was going to get to talk to the president, and who was going to be at this meeting, and who was going to get to speak. But sometimes it involved real issues. Example, Zionists, such as Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, fervently believed that only the existence of a Jewish state could prevent such a tragedy as the extermination of European Jews from happening again. And anything that set aside fighting for the goal of a Jewish state was just going to cause greater tragedies to happen in the future. Bergson, the Palestinian Jew, said, forget fighting for a Jewish state, fight for rescue. Non-Zionists, or anti-Zionists, of which there were still many, feared that introducing Zionism into any conversation would alienate many Jews and further fracture the Jewish community. Now, today, while it seems incomprehensible to us that these issues took precedence over saving Jews or saving lives, at the moment, many Jews were convinced that their solution would actually do so. And there's a wonderful book by two historians. It came out in the 80s, but I think it's a really good analysis of this whole situation by Richard Brightman and Alan Kraut. And they make the compelling argument, and it really struck me when I read it, and when I went back to look at it again, it struck me just as strongly as when I first saw it, that one of the reasons American Jews fought so vigorously amongst themselves was they lacked any real power to affect change in or to compel amongst the Washington establishment. Their infighting was a reflection of their powerlessness. And that one of the mistakes we made is to superimpose the American Jewish community of today, as I talked about a moment ago, and I'll talk about again in a few minutes more, presentism, to impose the power and the organization of the contemporary American Jewish community on that of the 1940s. In fact, one historian, in an attempt to prove that Jews were not powerless and could have gotten the government to act, in other words, he's from the very critical school, points to rallies that Rabbi Wise organized in March of 1933. To convince the Germans Germans to postpone the boycott of Jewish stores. Wise had been successful then. The Nazis had a one-day boycott. They had planned to have an ongoing boycott of Jewish stores. Rabbi Wise organized rallies, particularly here in New York, protesting this boycott and to some degree even calling on American Jews to boycott German goods, and the Germans stopped the Jewish boycott in Germany and held it to one day. So this historian says, well, Wise was successful then. Why didn't he replicate his success later in the decade throughout the 30s? And this historian argues, look, American Jews were able to gather 500,000 signatures on a petition opposing America's participation in the Olympics. And American Jews were responsible for getting Senator Wagner and Representative Edith Norris Rogers to introduce special legislation for the admission of 20,000 German Jewish refugee children. That legislation was introduced right after Kristallnacht. So this historian, Saul Friedman, says, clearly, Jews had political clout. They got 500,000 signatures on a petition, we shouldn't go to the Olympics. They managed to introduce this legislation, etc. The fact is, however, we went to the Olympics despite the 500,000 signatures. The legislation failed because of opposition in the Congress, particularly from the South and from many groups, many, not only, but Republicans as well. So, in other words, you have these examples, but they didn't work. None of them succeeded. So the critics, when the critics complain about American Jews' propensity to continue to vote for Roosevelt, despite his failings, you know, people say, Jews continued to vote for Roosevelt despite his failings on all this. That's a legitimate criticism unless you think about the alternative. The alternative were the Republicans, who were even more opposed to immigration and even more opposed to involvement in Europe. Roosevelt had to create this whole lend-lease myth to save Britain, which was collapsing. He had to do it over Republican opposition. So, yes, American Jews continued to vote for Roosevelt, and maybe that was, you know, throwing away their votes because he wasn't responding to their issue. But the option, they didn't do it just because of their love of the New Deal, but in part because of Roosevelt's more interventionist foreign policy. Indicative, if you want to think, realize how deep-seated isolationism had become in the United States, was the fact that during the 1940 presidential campaign, Wendell Willkie was so strongly opposed to American intervention abroad that Roosevelt felt compelled to promise that he would never send American soldiers into a foreign war. He was responding to Willkie. So if you were looking for someone who was going to respond to what was going in Europe, the Republicans, the alternative to FDR was not the way to go. And this is, again, something that you've got to keep in mind if you're going to ask why American Jews kept voting for FDR. What about Rabbi Wise specifically? What about his silence when he received this news of in August 42? How could he keep quiet about the destruction, mass murder of European Jews, which Gerhard Regner refers to in the telegram? If you read the telegram, it's pretty horrifying, but Regner qualifies it. He says, I can't confirm this. I have been told that planned extermination is going to happen, but I can't, and again he repeats it, but I cannot confirm if this is true. I don't know. So he hedges, he passes on this horrible information, but he hedges it. He says, I don't know if it's really true. Now, what if Wise had publicized the information after receiving it? It turned out not to be true. And what if he had ignored the State Department? The State Department asked him to be silent, and what if he had ignored it? Well, the State Department was his only, it wasn't like he could ignore the State Department. If he had ignored the State Department and angered them, any information he would have gotten would have been cut off, because that's where he was getting his information. And in fact, at the end of November, he gets the information beginning of August, at the middle of, about the third week in November, the State Department calls him in and says, yes, it's true. And you can publicize it. So he calls a press conference, and I knew way back from when I did my research on the American press coverage. I read dozens, if not tens, close to 100 different newspapers of that press conference. And the headlines read, Dr. Wise claims, Dr. Wise asserts, Dr. Wise avers, State Department doesn't comment. So in other words, it was his news. And the State Department kept silent. 2 weeks later, mid-December, there is an important announcement by all the allied nations, America, France, occupied France, but the French government in exile, Britain, Canada, Australia, etc., and the Soviet Union, that there was a planned program of annihilation underway. So that's December 42, 1 year after Pearl Harbor. It is announced. So why suddenly it's not Wise's information, it's everybody's information. But I don't know, was it wise for Wise to have gone along with the State Department? Should he have challenged it? It was a strategic decision which was very hard to make. And if he had announced it in August 42 and the State Department said, we don't know whether it's true or not, I can assure you the American press would have treated him like he was a crazy. So it was this no-option kind of situation. Now, it's true, Weiss can be rightly criticized for the fact, once he, at one point he told Felix Frankfurter how, of his wish that the skipper, that's how he called FDR, might see some information about the persecution of Jews, but he didn't want to burden him with it. And you read that, you get. Now, he wasn't talking about information about destruction. It was information of persecution. Still, you wonder how he could have kept it silent, but he wasn't suppressing news of mass murder. He was not passing on to Roosevelt news of persecution. What about his failure to use his supposed close relationship with FDR? Well, the fact of the matter is he didn't have such a close relationship with FDR. He had a very close relationship with FDR when FDR was governor. But then at one point he criticized FDR for his handling of certain union matters and certain matters treating state employees, etc. FDR became very angry with him, and his relationship with him was full of tension after that. And privately, he was critical of FDR. He complained about FDR's indifference, but he didn't do it publicly. He complained in the end of 33, FDR hasn't lifted a finger on the behalf of Jews of Germany. But he didn't say that publicly. Should he have said it publicly? One doesn't know. If he had said it publicly, I'm not sure America at large would have cared very much. Was it a strategic decision of, I'm annoyed with FDR, but I'm not going to say anything publicly because he's our only option right now? It's hard to know. Ultimately, however, to say that American Jews simply didn't care about their fellow Jews seems really inconsistent when you look at American Jews' history prior to that. As Henry Feingold, one of the great historians of American Jewry, observes, in 1840, American Jewry responded strongly to the Damascus blood libel, a blood libel in Damascus, or the Martara case in Italy in 1858, or the Kishinev pogroms in 1903, much of which came from this synagogue, with Jacob Schiff leading the charge on that, or the Francis Dreyfus affair. They didn't turn their back on European Jewry. So if you have a Jewish community, a much weaker Jewish community, that is responding to all these things for the 100 years before that, how do you explain one that suddenly says, we don't care? It doesn't make sense. And furthermore, a year after the final solution, that same community is working assiduously to help establish a Jewish state, including breaking the law and running guns and getting munitions to this new Jewish state. So how do you explain that suddenly in that middle period when this terrible situation is happening, they don't care? I think they did care, but they just, A, couldn't put their mind about what was happening, as almost nobody could, including Jews in Europe, to fully grasp what was happening, number one. And number two, they didn't have a sense of what they might do. Their options were so limited. It wasn't, and moreover, never before had a so-called enlightened nation so brutalized its entire Jewish population. This was something unprecedented. Number one. Number two, never before had American Jews, especially prior to Pearl Harbor, been compelled to take a position which ran directly 92% against what most Americans wanted. Damascus blood libel, most American non-Jews could have cared less. The Mortara case, where a little boy was taken and baptized in Italy and the Vatican refused to allow that child to be returned to his Jewish parents, most American Jews could care less. Most Americans could care less. So American Jews could push on that. Dreyfus, most Americans could care less. They could push on that. But when you're in the 1940s, when most Americans dread the thought of going into a war, the idea of pushing for something that suggests involvement in a war was something that was decidedly unpopular. So that never before had American Jewish interests been so at odds with what America wanted. Some of you may have recently read the book In the Garden of the Beast on William Dodd. Some of you may know earlier works by Robert Dalek and even much more extensive work on Dodd. But In the Garden of the Beast, since we use that as a reference to some of you familiar with it, it makes the point that Dodd, when he arrives in Germany, first thinks the news of the Jews is exaggerated, and then when he sees what's going on, he becomes very troubled by it. And he becomes very hostile to Hitler and his cohorts. And the State Department, remember, he's there because he's a friend of FDR's, not because he's one of the striped pants boys, one of the State Department boys. And the State Department works to get him recalled. And he goes to meet with FDR, and FDR says, I'll give you one more year. And shortly thereafter, he's recalled. Now, this is a man who has a personal relationship with FDR, gets a promise from FDR, and still the State Department still manages to get him recalled. So if a personal friend of President Roosevelt could not overcome the objections of the State Department, it's questionable to wonder whether the Jewish community could have changed American policy. Then another factor, and I mentioned this earlier, but again, let me stress, we all know that America won the war. You know, when we look back on World War II, again, we're thinking, okay, we won the war. But go read the newspapers from 42. Go read the newspapers, certainly up to the Battle of Midway, or Stalingrad, through a good part of 43. There's real doubt whether we're going to win the war. Is that a time when you're going to push for certain actions when it's unclear that America's going to win? Now, maybe you can, maybe you should. But put yourself in the mind and the shoes of the people then. Also, put yourself in the mind of the hundreds and thousands of Jewish GIs who felt, read their diaries, read their letters, read the books on them. G.I. Jew, I think it is, Deborah Dashmore's wonderful book on that whole period, where lots of these young men wrote letters and kept diaries, how this was their means of fighting Hitler. This was how they were going to respond. Finally, I think what there's something that Samantha Power, the human rights scholar in her wonderful book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, points out, that American policymakers have always been slow to muster the imagination to deal with issues of genocide. Just this afternoon, I was on a panel with Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, talking about genocide prevention. And I talked about it from a historical point of view, and he, of course, talked about his contemporary experience. And he talked about the fact that when things were going on in the former Yugoslavia, how hard it was to get the diplomats, how hard it was to get people to do something, especially when they didn't feel that their ox was being gored. So today diplomats don't react without being pushed, and they don't doubt what's going on. In the 1940s, they could at least say, oh, we don't know if this is true. So there was even more excuse in the 1940s. Finally, what about the defensive school, the pro-FDR school? It, too, goes way overboard. It argues that every Jew could have been saved who was saved, and that's just ludicrous. There were so many Jews who could have come into this country in the immigration quotas, the quota from Germany. You know, every country had a quota of a number of places. The quota of places for Germany was not filled until 1938. Not because any dearth of Jews trying to get in, but because the barriers were too high. These critics claim that the Jews didn't really want to leave, and that's why they didn't push to get in. All kinds of arguments which really make no sense. The defenders of FDR also say there was a very strong anti-Nazi feeling, and FDR pushed this anti-Nazi feeling. He inculcated this anti-Nazi feeling in America. That's true. He did do that. But that anti-Nazi feeling did not translate into sympathy for the Jews. In the 1930s in America, there was strong anti-Nazism, and there was also rising anti-Semitism. One historian once observed that one of Hitler's greatest exports was anti-Semitism. And people had the feeling, well, you don't want them, we don't want them either. They're so terrible, well, maybe you don't think they're as terrible as you think, but we don't want them here as well. So you can't ignore that either. To bring this all together, is this a historical argument, or is this moral judgments? How do we explain these different conclusions offered by these two sides. And the fact, one of the things that struck me is usually when you have a historical argument, one side will say, they're wrong, this one's wrong, I'm right, they're wrong, etc. No, in this argument, the other side is perverse, they're immoral, they're misleading, they're ahistorical, they're inauthentic. The level of the disagreement is so high that you got to think something else is going on. The critics talk about Rabbi Wise lunching or on vacation. They talk about subservient American Jews, obsequious in their requests. They were accomplices. They were docile. They were silent. Elie Wiesel wonders why Stephen S. Wise did not engage in acts of civil disobedience before the White House when he got this information. It's just something that wasn't in people's ken at the time. It's times when you listen to these two critics, two bodies arguing against each other, you see that there seems to be more moral than historical analysis. It seems to be judgment. So how do we explain it? I think they're emotional, political, ideological, and ultimately generational factors at play here. First, the emotional. For both sides, certainly for the critical school, for those who are critical of the White House, of FDR, of the established Jewish community, in part it's a cri de cœur, a cry of the heart, a cry of the deepest anguish at this terrible tragedy. And the failure, and the seeming failure when you go back and read about it, that nobody seemed to care. And it can make you nuts. For the defensive school, it's also a cry of anger. But their anger is, how could you take this FDR, whom they think of as such a impeccable, almost a godlike figure, you Jews who once were his greatest fans, and how could you so quickly turn into his critics? How can you ignore the fact that he appoints not one, but or nominates a Jew to the Supreme Court when there was already another Jew on the Supreme Court. Today, we're used to that. Then it was very, very strange. How could you ignore the fact that he appointed Jews to more positions, open doors to Jews in government employment, facts which never had been possible before? There's a moral argument made. David Wyman, who believes, son of two Protestant ministers, he believes that American foreign policy should be shaped by Christian love, by moral behavior, that America has a certain morality level to which it should live up to. Some of the other critics of FDR are people who feel that FDR wasn't such a liberal and really helped institutionalize, revive capitalism, and help the banks and industry. Sound familiar? So it's sometimes those who are critical of him are those who are critical of him for other reasons. Then there's what does it mean to be an American Jew? The defenders of FDR are appalled by anyone who would suggest that putting Jewish interests ahead of American interests. The critics argue we aren't putting Jewish interests in front of American interests. American interests should have been to save these people. Robert Rosen, one of the great FDR's great defenders, Americans should have been Jews, Americans first and Jews second. The other side arguing that that's just a fallacious kind of argument. Then there's the theological difference, and this really focuses on Rabbi Wise from the more right-wing Orthodox community, Aguda and others, who argue that Wise was Zionist leaders. First of all, they're going to attack Zionists, ridiculous and heartless for concentrating on a Jewish homeland when Jews were being slaughtered like sheep. As late as April 2010, Rabbi Ephraim Kestenbaum, the son of a fervently Orthodox Rabbi David Kestenbaum, who was trying to rescue Jews during the Holocaust, claimed that Stephen Wise had given the son a message for his father: tell your father that he has to be an American and not to fight so hard for Jews in Europe. You have to be an American first. The chance that Stephen Wise said something like that to the son of Rabbi Kestenbaum just beggars the imagination. And Kestenbaum says, again, almost absolving Roosevelt, but for Wise, Roosevelt would have done more to save Jews from the gas chambers. And Wise was treacherous. It's so over the top that it just, historically, it holds no water. And you get this from others who argue that Wise and those around him were assimilationists who put their loyalties to America ahead of their loyalties to fellow Jews. Now, what's interesting about this part is a lot, you track when this argument gets even more severe, argument against Rabbi Wise, argument against FDR, a lot of it comes in the mid-1970s. And also the defense of Peter Bergson, very strong, coming in the mid-1970s. Well, what else happens in the mid-1970s? There's a political upheaval in Israel. For the first time, you don't have a labor government anymore. You have Menachem Begin, heir to Jabotinsky, elected prime minister of Israel. For the first time, labor was not in a position to make policy. Now, I don't contend, I'm not arguing here, that the critics simply felt emboldened to speak out because of the election. But it's interesting to consider whether the election, that election, and the cataclysmic rejection it represented of David Ben-Gurion's legacy did not embolden certain critics. Did not make people feel, hey, tables are being turned. Maybe it was unconscious. But FDR's defenders saw it as that. Lucy Davidovich branded the critics of Roosevelt as, quote, engaged in a retrospective alliance with the Irgun, whose commander was none other than Menachem Begin. So the defenders of FDR made that connection. And then there's another factor, and here's where I talk about generationally, and I'm talking quite personally, as one of those who's been and remains, as I said, critical of America, we began our work, we began to write, my generation of historians, in the 70s, when it was the Vietnam generation, the generation that was looking back at American Jews of previous generations and saying, we can do things better, we can do things different. Not only Jews, but lots of us were abiding by the statement, complete idiocy, don't trust anyone over 30. As if we weren't going to get to be 30. What were we thinking, you know? What kind of stupidity? But in our ranks were also Jews, products of leading Jewish educational institutions, camps, youth groups, schools, who felt completely comfortable in our American Jewish skin. It was a different America. It was a multicultural America. It was America where it was not only okay, but it was almost sometimes desirable to be ethnic. We felt fully free to express ourselves as Jews. And the thought, when we looked back and said, what, they didn't express themselves as Jews? They worried about what others might say? How could such a thing be possible? It's a classic example, and I myself was guilty of it, of presentism. Taking who we were now and using that as a measuring rod against what had been in the past. So while there is much that is very valid of the criticism of FDR, the criticism of Rabbi Wise, to some degree they lack historicity. We evaluate the Roosevelt administration, we evaluate American Jewry, not on what they did and who they were, but what they should have done and what they should have been, that they failed to live up to our standards. You can't do history like that. So that too, I think, is part of the problem. You don't want to edge onto apologia and try to explain it away. At the same time, you can't use your standards to impose them on their own. And I want to close, and it's quite fitting for everything we've watched the past couple of days happening in Washington, with a gut feeling for which I have no definitive proof. I put that right up. But it's just a gut feeling. In the past decade, sectors of the American Jewish community have been become increasingly politically conservative, or, put it more accurately, less reliably democratic with a large D. It's not only in the Orthodox Jewish community, it's across the board. Some of this criticism may well be emanating from that change. For instance, political pundit Dennis Prager told the Republican Jewish Coalition that, quote, they'd still be gassing Jews if liberals and peace activists had their way. Or that Gandhi did a lot of great work in India, and you know why? Because when you advocate peaceful resistance against the British, it works. Peaceful resistance against evil does not work. It's possible. I don't know if it's true, but it's possible if some, certainly not all, the criticism of FDR, Stephen Wise, and the faithful support by American Jews of the Democratic Party during the 1930s and 40s may be a means of trying to justify, pry loose, understand this changing political alienation of alignment of American Jews. They failed us in the 1940s. Will they fail us in 2012? It's a serious question, but the problem is, and I say this both with a background of my work on American Jewry and also my background of a work on Holocaust deniers. And of course, no one here is akin to the Holocaust deniers, not at all. But speaking quite seriously, when you use history for political purposes, not to learn from history, I do history because I think it can teach us things. I'm fascinated by it, and I also think it has contemporary relevance and can teach us things. But we have to be very, very careful of taking history and using it as a political tool, twisting it, perverting it, changing it in order to justify contemporary standings. It's very possible. This is a debate that's going to go on, and my guess is that despite the passage of over 7 decades, this debate may only be resolved by the next generation of historians of the American Jewish community, those with somewhat less volatile an attitude towards the issue. Thank you very much. Okay. I saw your people wandering.
Yes, they are. It is working?
Yes.
Hello. They are gathering some of the questions. Now, as we wait for the questions, I would like to ask the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Then some or most of your lecture,
mm-hmm.
for me as a Jew who grew up in Argentina, for me is, you know, I was part of a different movie. You know, the Perón question is the question for me. But I came to this country 20 years ago, and I can tell you that one of the most mentioned recurrent issues that I hear from American Jews, as I build my own conception of how American Jews see their Judaism, is the question you address tonight about the reaction of American Jewry to the Holocaust. And you quoted a lot of literature. I have not been able yet to answer why that question persists as a major question in the formation of the identity of the American Jew.
It's a great question, Alfredo. It's a wonderful question. And I could almost spend the rest of the time trying to answer that and not sure I could succeed. I think, first of all, as I said earlier, it's the cri de coeur. It runs so counter of what so many of us want to believe about our country, that our country stands up when it sees unmitigated evil taking place, that it responds. And of course there would be those who argue it did. It got into the war because Germany declared war on us. I'm not sure if Pearl Harbor had been bombed, Of course, and that was an act of war, so we were in war with Japan. But if Germany hadn't declared war with us, whether we would have gone into war. But that's a when we declared war on Germany, it was in response to their declaring war on us. But going back to your question, I think the Shoah, and people say, oh, I heard too much about the Shoah, etc. It still sits there. I mean, if there's still survivors alive today, there's still perpetrators alive today, it's in our lifetime that one out of every three Jews was murdered. And the whole world, Shaul Friedlander makes this so powerfully, it makes this point so powerfully in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Years of Extermination, on the history of that 41 through 45, where he says, not one institution in Europe, not one religious, educational, political, cultural, not one institution in Europe spoke up on behalf of the Jews. And I think that it partially is that feeling of having been so completely abandoned. And if you are an identifying and strongly identifying American, you sort of, it just runs counter with everything you want to believe about this country. And one of the great things I think about this country is that it's willing to look into the dark places of its history. I don't think there's anything wrong with the president, whomever he may be, apologizing for when we got things terribly wrong. I think that's what Bill Clinton was doing on that opening day of the Holocaust Museum. I think it only redounds to who we are, but I think it also touches on the question, and again, just to finish this now, who are we as American Jews? And maybe some of us thought this the past couple of days as we watched events in Washington. Should things go wrong? Should things happen in a way, let's say Israel takes action that America doesn't want, how do our identities play out? It's not so simple. It's not so integrated. It doesn't mean that it's in conflict. But it's not simple. So that's I don't know if that's a full answer, but it's at least the beginnings of an answer.
I will read this literally. Alfredo, lots of people want to know about Iran. Okay, they are not okay. Now, a lot of people may leave today without knowing about Iran.
About Iran today?
About the current situation, you know, it's an unfair question because it's not what you came to talk about today.
No, let me say something about Iran, that there are too many people talking about what should be done in Iran who have no idea of what the situation is, myself included. Et chata'ai ani maskir hayom, my own sins do I acknowledge today. I have a friend, a colleague, who has said Israel should bomb. I said, but what if the nuclear facilities are spread in 1,000 different places, as some people have said, or hundreds of different places. Oh, no, most they're 12, and 12 they can get. This is a very smart person. This is a very accomplished professor. I think there's a lot we don't know.
But let me ask you a question following that. You, as a person who has dedicated your life to the study of the Holocaust, how does it resonate within you when the Holocaust is used as a paradigm or an analogy to the current situation?
Okay. I would say that too often in the past, the Holocaust is used too cheaply as an analogy. I have heard people say, you know, especially as we saw over the past couple of years, serious increase of anti-Semitism, particularly in Europe. Look, when rabbis tell their local co-religionists, whether it's in Belgium or it's in Netherlands, or tell visiting Jewish tour groups, it's better if you wear yarmulkes to wear a hat. If you're going to the synagogue as a group, you should have a guard. Or when I go to Germany, I ask for directions to the synagogue, and people tell me, go this street, that street, and when you get on that street, you'll recognize it because there is a police car and a soldier with a submachine gun in front of the synagogue. That's pretty disturbing. That's really worrisome. But it's not a Holocaust. Someone recently said to me, a woman who was very worried. She's not a silly woman, she's not a stupid woman at all, but she's really worried. There had been a number of firebombings of cars near synagogues here in New York. And she said, look, we're seeing it happen in our own community. I said, what? She said, this is like Berlin in 1939. And I said to her, and I tried to say it as gently as possible, because she was speaking out of fear, and I think I want to track her irrationality to that. I said, in Berlin in 1938 and 39, when these kind of things were happening, first of all, they were much worse. Second of all, they were being done by people sponsored by the government. Today, when you have something like that, the mayor, the chief of police, the borough president are all standing there condemning this and committing themselves to tracking it down. So things can be bad. Things can be worrisome. Things can be troublesome without immediately going to a Holocaust. Now, Iran, if Iran had a nuclear weapon and let it loose, then you have an analogy.
Let me ask you, you know, as I read the questions, one more question after a very, very complete lecture. Where do you see the place of the Holocaust as an educational tool in the next 10 years? How should we use the Holocaust in our curriculum, in our learning? Which place should have in the narrative of the Jew today?
You know, this is a battle that I've completely, I've won some important battles in my life, thank God for that, but this is a battle that I've completely lost. I think we teach kids about the Holocaust way too young. I think, you know, the place to seriously start studying about the Holocaust is in high school. I think it's hard for little kids to fully understand it. You know, Pharaoh, Hitler, you know, Haman, going to celebrate Purim this week. I think we at times educate before kids are ready to really learn. The place of the Holocaust, I mean, I don't know. I don't even think in those terms. I'm a Jew, and I know that people here know me personally, and they can vouch for it if I need vouching for it. I'm a Jew who delights in her Jewish identity, who delights in her Jewish heritage, who is, you know, and fights with all sorts of, invite me, you want a lively dinner party, invite me. I'll take whatever opinion is the minimal opinion at the table, and believe it for the moment, then I'll go to the next house and I'll argue with them. But I delight in being and having gotten access, my parents, you know, making sure that we got an A1 Jewish education, that we went to Jewish camps, were part of youth groups, that we were fully, you know, identifying. It wasn't a bifurcation. We went to the Met, we went to the opera, we went to the museums, and we went to shul. I mean, it was all an integrated life. And into that integrated life, I learned about the Holocaust. The only time I would see my father cry during the year was when at the Passover Seder he would say a prayer for or commemorate before we opened the door for Eliyahu, Shvach Hamatcha, when we did that for the victims of the Shoah. And he was thinking, I'm sure, about classmates of his and friends of his immediate family got out, but distant family members. He was German Jew. But that wasn't the focus of our Jewish identity. I think we have to be as comfortable v'samachta b'chagecha, rejoicing on our holidays, as we are about mourning the bad stuff. We need a holistic, so it's not what's the place of the Holocaust, it's how do we develop and how do we ensure, you know, you're running this incredible educational program here. It's got to be incredible, brought me here to speak, you know. Just a joke.
Even more now, yes.
Yes, even more now, you know, you've another jewel. No. It's a program that is known nationwide, if not beyond that. And it's got to be all of it. So I bristle when people say to me, well, write an article for us, but don't write it about the Holocaust. And I think we have to know about Jew as object, what is done to Jews, and we have to live Jew as subject, what Jews do. We have to know how Jews were persecuted, and we have to know how Jews lived and how they rejoiced. It's a holistic kind of thing. So I don't think there's one specific place, but it's an integrated whole. And I think I can do the work I do on the Holocaust because I have that other part of my identity.
I want to thank you again.
Thank you.
For teaching us, and certainly, as you did now, for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That, may you have a happy Purim, a Purim of joy, and certainly I would love to see you again at our classrooms, lectures, studying together, and toda rabba. Have a good night.